States against Kindle. Ms. Crosley.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Adair Crosley on behalf of Mr. Leslie Mayfield. Given the limited amount of time that I have, I'm going to focus on the fact that Mr. Mayfield was entitled to present an entrapment defense and that the District Court erred in preventing him from doing so. However, I'd be happy to answer any other questions this Court may have. This Court has recognized that whether or not a defendant has been entrapped is largely a factual issue and therefore typically not amenable to pretrial resolution. That maxim applies in this case in full force. In this case, Mr. Mayfield alleged specific facts that, taken as true, were legally sufficient to show entrapment. In response, the government produced indirect evidence that suggested Mr. Mayfield may have been predisposed, but provided no evidence that directly contradicted Mr. Mayfield's allegations of inappropriate behavior by the government's confidential informant. The district court, according to this court's precedent,
well, should have... What would be the evidence of his, having been persuaded to, by means that wouldn't have been used by an ordinary criminal? I mean, suppose he'd been approached by, suppose Potts and Gomez had been honest criminals, and they really wanted him to help them, with a stash house robbery. So wouldn't he have yielded to the same types of blandishments that these government agents used?
Your Honor, I think that the courts hold the government to a higher standard in these kinds of cases. I think there's policy reasons about entrapping defendants. We don't want the unwary innocent getting caught up. And I think that there's got to be a line.
No, but this fellow had a history of robberies, right? He was a robber. Okay. So the question is, if there hadn't been this sting, isn't it pretty likely that he would have been involved in this sort of thing? That guys like this, but they say honest criminals, would have come to him and say, you know, we have this, we have our eyes on this stash house, a lot of money there, but we need tough guys to overcome the defense of these stash houses. Isn't that very likely?
It's not unlikely that someone would have approached him to commit a crime. However, would someone have resorted to giving him money unsolicitedly?
Well, why not? I mean, look. What was it, $180? Some trivial amount? If you're this, these stash houses have really valuable property in it. To give $180 to someone who you think you can persuade to, with his armed accompaniments, to break into this very risky business, you'd think the $180 would be a trivial inducement.
You're absolutely correct that $180 relative to the amount of money in drugs in the alleged stash house is trivial. However, I would also point out that relative to Mr. Mayfield's means at the time, it was a lot of money. And also that this wasn't $180 from Chase Bank or from...
Yeah, but of course, the more money he needed, the more desperate he was, the more open he would be to this type of blandishment by honest criminals. Isn't it dangerous to have this fellow at large waiting for someone to come and offer him an opportunity to deploy his gang? And
Your Honor, whether or not Mr. Mayfield was dangerous, whether or not he was
He has these really bad friends. Everyone's armed and... Was he going to be just a peaceful citizen for the rest of his life? How old was he?
He's around 40.
When he committed the crime?
Yes.
All right, so he's not old yet.
Your Honor, there's plenty of evidence in the record that he was taking steps to turn his life around. He was legitimately employed. He was living with his girlfriend and her teenage children. Since leaving prison, he had been involved in Operation Ceasefire. He had been pretty much gainfully employed pretty consistently since his most recent release from
prison. How long was that?
I think about 3 years or so. He'd been as gainfully employed as he could, given he had a record. As you know, there are barriers to employment. He was working hard. He was trying to turn his life around. When the government, and I want to kind of go back to this point of, the government didn't just give him, didn't just ask him to do this, I'm out of time.
But clearly, he put up very little resistance to resuming a career of robberies. And again, my concern is that if the government hadn't arranged this, honest criminals would have, they knew about him, they knew his record, so on. He obviously has friends whom he can assemble into an armed gang.
Your Honor, do you disagree that we should hold the government to a higher standard than honest criminals? Do we want the government going around threatening, guys with criminal records?
I don't see the threat here.
The gangster, the invocation of the gangster disciples?
I don't see that. He's just showing he's a tough guy. He's a gang member. That doesn't mean he's threatening to. Look, what sense would it make for the gangster disciple to threaten a guy like this? He's not only a robber, he's got these pals, and they're armed to the teeth. I don't think you threaten another armed gang just to make him go along with it.
As a point of correction in the record, Mr. Mayfield testifies.
You're hiring a bunch of gunmen?
Your Honor, Mr. Mayfield testified, and there's no evidence to contradict this, that in fact Potts gave him the weapons, that they were not armed prior to Potts arming them with the weapons. So
all the weapons, the shotgun and so on,
yes,
came from Potts?
Correct. This is in the record, according to Mr. Mayfield's testimony, and the government produced nothing to contradict this, which goes back to kind of the real point.
Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Chaffee.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Imani Chaffee, and I represent Dwayne White. Mr. White was charged and convicted in this case of conspiring to rob a fictional stash house with intent to possess and distribute cocaine. In addition, he was charged and convicted of attempting to rob that same fictional stash house to possess with intent to distribute cocaine. For today's argument, I just want to focus on whether there was sufficient evidence to convict Mr. White beyond a reasonable doubt of conspiring to rob this stash house of cocaine and to distribute it. Your Honor, I think based on the record in this case, I think the answer to our question is no. Mr. White didn't participate in any of the initial meetings between his co-defendants, Mr. Potts, or undercover officer Gomez. I think the record shows there were at least three meetings. Mr. White didn't participate in any of these meetings. His name was never mentioned in these meetings by his co-defendants to Mr. Potts or to Mr. Gomez. In addition, there's no evidence in the record that suggests that Mr. White participated in discussions with Mr. Mayfield, Mr. Kendall, or Mr. Ward, or entered into any agreement with them that he was going to possess cocaine with the intent to distribute that cocaine. There was no evidence from Mr. Gomez's testimony, and there was no evidence produced during Mr. Mayfield's testimony as well. In addition, when Mr. White arrived at the staging location, the storage facility in this case, the only comment, the only thing that he said when told about Mr. Gomez's ultimate plan, the final plan of this robbery, or the objective of this robbery, the only thing that Mr. White said was, "Oh, yeah." And I think the record shows that Mr. Gomez, upon seeing Mr. White and not being convinced that Mr. White knew anything about what was happening or knew the objectives, knowing that this was a robbery to possess with intent to distribute cocaine, Mr. Gomez launches into the entire plan of the robbery. He goes into the how many people are going to be armed at this stash house, the amount of cocaine that they believe was going to be in the stash house. This is all from Mr. Gomez, mind you. The only evidence in the record where anyone ever told Mr. White about cocaine, about possessing cocaine, and about distributing that cocaine, that came from undercover agent Gomez. Mr. White's only response to this was, "Oh, yeah."
A man of few words.
Well, he was
well
a man
chosen.
He was a man of few words, Your Honor, and a man who did not, we believe the record shows, agree to possess with intent to distribute cocaine in this case. In addition, there's no evidence that, and I may have already covered this, no evidence that Mr. White expressed any willingness to possess cocaine with intent to distribute it. So I think what we have here concerning Mr. White is a person who shows up who, let me back up, a person who does not participate in any of the initial meetings, doesn't participate in the planning of this fictional robbery, who shows up on the alleged day of this robbery. There's no evidence to show that he entered into any agreement with his co-defendants to possess with intent to distribute this cocaine. And a person who expressed no willingness or any evidence from Mr. White himself that he had entered into an agreement to possess with intent to distribute. We believe, Your Honors, that the government has failed to meet this burden in this case, and they have failed to show that Mr. White conspired with his co-defendants to possess with intent to distribute cocaine in this case, and the court should reverse. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. I represented Montrese Kindle, and this is the appeal for Montrese Kindle. He was tried in a separate trial from his co-defendants. And the way the facts came out in that case, Your Honors, is that there was absolutely no evidence that any of the co-defendants had any prior agreements or relationships at all, specifically regarding to drug distribution. And I'd like to concentrate on that issue here on appeal. We did raise in our brief the sufficiency of the evidence as well for the attempt charge. But the issue that I'd like to address is whether there is an agreement to steal cocaine from a stash house or a fictitious stash house by itself, is that sufficient to constitute an agreement for the distribution of that cocaine? And I submit to Your Honors, based on the line of cases starting with Lechuga, ending recently with USA versus Johnson, that there isn't. I know the government is going to step up here, as they did in their appeal briefs, and claim that the buyer-seller relationship is not analogous to what we have here. It is analogous. It is exactly the same. Just because somebody is a buyer-seller doesn't mean that in a situation where these individuals supposedly were going to a stash house to take or to steal the cocaine, they were also going to have an agreement to distribute the cocaine. In USA versus Lechuga, Your Honors, this court said when the sale, which could be analogous to a robbery of some commodity, is the substantive crime, the sale or the robbery agreement itself can't be the conspiracy. It has no separate criminal objective. Here, the objective was the robbery. That was the underlying crime. I think even in their brief, the government says that there was ample evidence of a conspiracy to rob. We are not disputing that, but that was not the charge in this case. The charge in this case was possession with intent to distribute. It's a distribution conspiracy that the government charged my client with. And so, for example, if these few individuals got in one car and went to the stash house to actually buy cocaine from somebody, but they didn't go there to buy cocaine for their benefit as a group, but they were going together because it was cheaper to get there in one car and buy and then leave their separate ways. That's essentially what happened here. And that's essentially what Your Honor's called a buyer-seller agreement. Doesn't matter if the quantity of the cocaine is a distribution amount of cocaine. It matters what was going to be done or what the agreement was. And the government did not prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. As far as the attempt possession, there was no substantial step by Mr. Kindle in this case taken. Yes, he did convene in a meeting with Agent Gomez, and the plot was explained, and later on he came and met with them, but they were arrested at the storage facility. And in the storage facility, there was no phone call yet to say where the stash house is, if it's close by, if it's far away, if it's going to happen. As you know from prior cases, a lot of times in drug dealings, changes happen last minute. The load didn't get to the stash house. The police stopped the van or the truck that the load was coming in, and so it didn't get there. The person got cold feet. My client was supposedly going to be the getaway driver. He did not know of the guns that were in the car. There was actually evidence that the closest gun to him was covered, and without the police searching it for it, you couldn't really see it inside the car. They did not know whether or not Agent Gomez will get the call. They did not know if there's going to be any changes. And finally, and probably most importantly, once the call did come through, will Mr. Kindle get cold feet and not come out and continue on?
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Jeff Percanti on behalf of the United States. If I might, I'd like to start with Mr. Kindle and Mr. White's sufficiency arguments briefly and then turn to the entrapment argument that Mr. Mayfield referenced today. I'm only going to discuss the arguments that the defendants referenced today unless the Court would like me to address the other arguments that are in our briefs. Otherwise, I'll just rest on the briefs on those arguments. Both Mr. Kindle and Mr. White ignore evidence that was introduced at trial, most importantly, the statements that they made after they were arrested. Mr. White, for example, after he said, "Oh yeah," as Mr. Chaffee mentioned, and Agent Gomez went through the stash house robbery scenario, he was arrested. He had a ski mask in his pocket in the middle of August on what the agent testified was a hot day.
He's a very strong athlete.
Right. I don't know how many. But he has a ski mask in the middle of August. I don't know how many folks actually wear ski masks, but he had one in the middle of August on a hot day. He's arrested. He tells the agent, "I'm lucky you didn't catch me with the work." That was the sanitized statement that we had to introduce at trial because of Bruton issues. What he really said is, we're lucky you didn't catch us with the work. The work, of course, meaning cocaine. That is evidence that he was there that day to rob the stash house that he was told about, that he acknowledged he knew about. Mr. Kindle also ignores his own confession, his statement that Mayfield called him, asked him to come to a meeting in Naperville. When he got there, told him that he had a lick, which meant an armed robbery, brought him to the meeting with Agent Gomez, where they sat and talked about the robbery. After that meeting, Mayfield said, I want the guys inside the house taken out. We're going in right after Agent Gomez. Kindle agrees, I'll be the getaway driver. Comes back the next day with Mayfield and Ward again. Mr. White is there that day. First question he asks when he gets out of the car at the storage facility is, where do you know where the house is at? This is the getaway driver asking, do you know where the house is at? He was there intending to rob a stash house of a significant quantity of cocaine, repeatedly was told it was 25 to 35 kilos of cocaine, and essentially both now argue, well, is that enough? Is agreeing to rob a stash house of 25 to 35 kilos of cocaine enough to convict them of conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute cocaine? The answer, based on this court's case law, is yes. Strikingly, what happened in Corson is very similar to what happened here. The defendants in that case agreed to split the cocaine five ways, just like the defendants did here on the August 9th meeting, where Ward said, we're going to split this five ways. That's exactly what happened in Corson. This very similar argument was raised recently in Lewis, and that was that the defendant said, I wasn't going to distribute this cocaine, and I didn't know whether my co-defendants were either. The court rejected that and said, you were going to rob an armed stash house of a distribution quantity of cocaine. The jury could conclude from that that you intended to distribute that because, frankly, you'd be crazy to do otherwise. So for those reasons, Mr. White and Mr. Kindle's arguments fail. As to the entrapment defense that Mr. Mayfield wanted to raise, he proffered insufficient evidence to raise that defense.
I don't understand why the jury wasn't allowed to consider this. I mean, if you believed his testimony, he wasn't interested in going into the stash house robbery business, but this fellow Potts and then Gomez, who were, you know, working for the government, they persuaded him. Since the judge didn't allow the evidence to be presented, we don't really know what a jury would have thought, right? If they believed Mayfield, then he was entrapped.
Well, that's not correct, Judge. I think that, first of all, he wasn't allowed to present defense because he didn't provide evidence of predisposition. And as the court pointed out during counsel's argument, he had a history of doing these types of armed robberies.
Wait a second. Is there any evidence that he had ever robbed a stash house?
What he told the undercover. He told Agent Gomez.
Look, that's after he's agreed to do it. Now he's, you know, trying to build himself up and bragging and so on. But there's no actual evidence that he ever robbed a stash house. I mean, he could get up on the stand and say, yeah, I said that to Gomez because, you know, I'd agreed to do this. So I wanted him to be confident in me, you know, so I'd get paid and so forth.
Judge, I think there's multiple problems with that. First of all,
what is the indication that if Potts had never approached him, he nevertheless would have become a stash house robber?
Oh, I think his criminal history of armed robbery.
Look, but that's like saying that any con. You can go and instead of actually investigating a real crime, you can create the crime.
Well, Judge, I think that here, Mr. Mayfield.
What differentiates him from any other convict, right? So he was released from prison. Now there's some evidence that he's trying to go straight. now through Potts and Gomez, the government offers him blandishments to get back into the robbery business. You could do that with anyone. I mean, there are millions of people who have been convicted of and released from prison. You'd never have to investigate another real crime again. You could spend all your time just trying to persuade ex-cons.
Well, Judge, I think in addition to the fact that he has been convicted of armed robbery, armed vehicle hijacking, attempted murder.
When?
Well, he was convicted in the mid-90s, but he served until 2005 because of the nature of his offense. He received a lengthy
sentence. I know, but his last armed robbery was, what, 20 years ago?
It would have been, I believe, in 1994.
So when do you stop? I mean, someone who's committed a crime 20 years ago, you think is an appropriate target for a sting?
Well, Judge, he also, when he got out of jail in 2008, possessed a gun. Along with
another 100 million people who have guns?
Well, he's a convicted felon.
All the ex-cons?
He's a convicted felon with a gun, which certainly undercuts
his... Yeah, I know, but that doesn't mean he's going to go and rob a stash house just because he has a gun like everybody else.
Well, Judge, he also said, and I realize it was after he had contact with the
CIA. Yeah, well, that's important that it's after. I don't understand why this doesn't go to the jury.
Well, Judge, he said, you know, I've done this before, and while obviously that
happened... I don't understand why it isn't a jury issue.
Well, he, in response to the evidence that showed that he was predisposed...
Man, I don't know why you're even afraid of the jury. I mean, obviously the jury isn't going to accept his defense because they'll consider him a frightening person.
Well, and there was evidence that the government was not allowed to introduce because this defense did not go to the jury. The government moved in a 404B motion to introduce the
statement. Does anybody rob stash houses, or is stash house robbery strictly an invention of the government?
Judge,
it's one of your favorite stings, right?
Judge,
I understand the motive, because you go to these dopes and you say, wow, stash house, loads of cocaine, make millions, right? I understand that. But we seem to have a lot of these stash house sting cases.
Judge, I think it's because it's a realistic scenario. And Agent
realistic?
Gomez, Agent Gomez,
what's the incidence of stash house robberies?
Well, Judge, I think a lot of these go unreported.
That's a convenient thing for you to say. In other words, you have no information. So you say, oh, they're unreported.
So well, in the record, Judge...
Must be going on all over the place.
Agent Gomez testified that the development of this was...
The argument that if this is talked about a lot in the espionage world, if you can't find any evidence that the suspect is spying, that shows what a good spy he is. So it's actually evidence of guilt.
Well, Judge, I think that...
So you're saying these stash house robberies must be really skillful because nobody reports, nobody catches them.
Well, I don't think it's that nobody catches them. I think it's that folks who get robbed, who have drugs robbed from them, are not going to call the police and say, I just had my house robbed of 25 kilos of cocaine. Agent Gomez did testify, and it is in the record, that... the development of this scenario was meant to be realistic, and it certainly was realistic to these defendants. Leslie Mayfield talked about how he had done this before. The other defendants, when they're brought in, I mean, we have three defendants who are brought in by Leslie Mayfield here and who have all been convicted of conspiracy. None of them express that, wow, this is really outrageous amount of cocaine, that this, I've never heard anything this like this before. Each of them acknowledged, and the government was not allowed to introduce this evidence at trial, that they had done this before, that this type of robbery in the past. Leslie Mayfield talked at length about how he had done this in the past.
Why wasn't the government able to present the evidence?
We moved under Rule 404B to introduce it as a prior bad act that showed their intent, and the district court did not allow us to do that, saying that predisposition for all the defendants was not an issue in the case. So we were not allowed to introduce Mayfield's extensive statements that he had done this before, that he had used firearms to carry out these types of robberies in the past. Mr. White, when he came on the scene, was asked if he'd done this before, and he nodded yes. We were not allowed to put that in the record. And the same with Mr. Kendall and Mr. Ward. So there was evidence that all these folks, given this scenario, weren't so concerned with, I've never heard anything like this before. They were more concerned with, how are we getting inside? How many guys are there? Are they all going to be armed? And if they're going to have to kill all the guys inside the house or just shoot the first guy right away. So there was no, man, this is a very strange, I've never heard of anything like this. This was right in these guys' wheelhouse. And that is the goal of these stash house robberies, that these do happen. And it is not a reported crime that we can fight after the fact. It is something that needs to be pursued, and they are violent. Violent offenses committed by folks who trade in drugs and commit violent acts, like Mr. Mayfield. And so for that reason, and I realize that Mr. Mayfield's statements were made after his initial contact with the CI, and I understand that predisposition, we're looking at his intent prior to that initial contact. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at evidence after the fact, when he didn't know he was being recorded.
But if Mayfield is an appropriate target for this kind of sting, who isn't?
A person who would not be an appropriate target? I mean, I think the people that are
Wouldn't any person who'd been convicted of who'd ever been convicted of armed robbery be an appropriate target for you?
Well, not necessarily. Not ever convicted. I think part of what
happened. Why not?
Well, I think part of
what's special about him?
What's special about him is that he, according to the CI, approached the government, approached the CI about this, approached Potts about this. And then he had committed an additional offense.
Well, this is Potts' version.
I'm sorry, Judge?
Well, Potts has a version of their initial discussion, but he was never permitted to give his version.
He wasn't, and that's because Mr. Mayfield was unable to proffer any reason to call him other than...
Well, why isn't a good reason that you're picking on me because I was convicted of armed robbery 20 years ago, and I've been trying since I was released. I've been trying. I have a legitimate employment. I moved away from my bad associates. Isn't that enough to say, yeah, I'm entitled to present an entrapment defense?
Well, Judge, I think it's also here, Mr. Mayfield did not show any reluctance to commit the offense he was charged with. And I think that's something that is kind of glossed over.
Well, that's, of course, evidence. I mean, we're talking about evidence, which I think should have been presented to the jury.
Well, Judge, according to Mr. Mayfield, at least what my understanding of his argument on appeal is that he was essentially entrapped into entering into agreement with the CI. The problem is he wasn't charged with doing that, and he admitted that on August 9th and 10th, the day before and the day of the robbery, he was unable to contact the CI. And this court mentioned in Hall that's significant. If a defendant overcomes barriers thrown in his path, that shows his predisposition to commit the offense, because he had a way out here. He wasn't able to talk to Potts on August 9th or 10th. He could have said, hey, you didn't call me. I couldn't get a hold of you, so I didn't do the robbery. Instead, he brings in three other people on the 9th. He brings in three other people on the 10th. That's the offense that he was convicted of, was bringing in those folks, conspiring with those folks. He was not convicted.
But now you're giving a new twist to entrapment. You say there's never entrapment if the defendant could at the last minute have ducked out of the crime. But that's always possible, right? You can always change your mind.
Judge, I see I'm out of time. Can I answer your question?
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case. I think that what we're arguing is that...
No, that's what you're arguing. You're arguing if someone can change his mind, can withdraw from his agreement to commit the crime, then it shows he was predisposed. Didn't withdraw, so he must have been predisposed.
It's not that he didn't withdraw.
That's your argument.
He said he overcame obstacles that were thrown in his way, which is what this court in Hall mentioned showed a
lack
of reluctance.
Well, there are always obstacles in planning criminal activity. Anyway, I won't badger you anymore.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We thank the three of you, by the way, for your assistance to your client as well as the court. The case is taken under advisement.